Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could tune in this morning. In the wake of last week's airplane hijackings and terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, air travel is likely to change in significant ways. New security measures will increase both the costs and inconvenience of travel by air. And the impact on airlines is already driving some of them to bankruptcy. During this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about the future of air travel and how the changes underway by the industry and the government may affect passenger safety. Our guest is someone who has been concerned with air travel safety for some time. Mary Schiavo served as Inspector General for the U.S. Department of Transportation from 1990 to 1996. She is currently an aviation attorney and professor of aviation at Ohio State University. In her book, Flying Blind, Flying Safe, Mary Schiavo was highly critical of the performance of the Federal Aviation Administration in addressing airline safety. She continues to speak out on the issue, and during this hour, Focus 580, we'll get her thoughts about the current crisis in air travel, the measures that have been implemented and those proposed, and the impact they may have on the future of air travel. As we talk with Mary Schiavo, you are welcome to join the conversation. Your questions on the topic are welcome. All you need to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, if that makes it easier to dial. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us around the Midwest here, or via the Internet, anywhere you're listening, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Mary Schiavo, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
To begin, after all the attention paid to airport security in recent years, last week, four separate sets of hijackers were able to take over four separate passenger jets. Did we just get complacent, or was this bound to happen whenever a group of terrorists decided to make it happen?
Well, we were very, very complacent, in part because of an actual policy of the U.S. government, even in the wake of the Pan Am 103 bombing. The attitude of the FAA was that domestic aviation was not at risk for terrorist attack. And even in prepping for the Atlanta Olympics, where I met with the head of the FAA and other officials, it was simply the thought that it can't happen here, and that was a highly incorrect even then. I think in the first half of 97, the last figures I have, in the first half of 97, there were something like almost 100 thwarted instances of attempted terrorist attacks against U.S. aviation. So we have known that domestic aviation could be the target of an attack. And some of the conversations, for example, this scenario was discussed within the FAA. But the thought there was that somebody would steal a small plane, and at that particular time, they were worried about somebody stealing a small plane and ramming it into the UN tower.
Right. Well, you mentioned some 100 incidents. Was that within what period of time?
Just a half a year.
Were those reported? I don't remember.
Those are FBI figures. Those are not FAA figures, and it stems from everything from, domestic crazy things to you name it. But the FBI keeps those figures separately. The FBI is the one that keeps the numbers of terroristic attacks.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they're on the net. You can, log in to the FAA administrators, what's called the administrator's handbook, and some of those statistics are right out there.
How about that? Well, let's talk about who is responsible for making airports and airplanes secure. What role does the government play, the airline industry, and so forth?
Well, one thing that people have to understand is sort of the patchwork quilt way that aviation security works. First of all, within the Department of Transportation, the cognizant agency now is the Federal Aviation Administration. But the Federal Aviation Administration has very, very few security personnel in its ranks. In fact, it has more public relations personnel than security personnel. What it does is it oversees the security plans of each of our airports. Each airport has to draft their own security plan. Mm. And each airline has to submit a security plan for each of its installations and for its overall operation. And then the FAA approves those plans and spot checks whether they're living up to their plans. And that is our national security for our airport and aviation safety. And then it's still not the airline that does the security, even though they have the funding and the money and the responsibility. They farm it out to the lowest bidder.
So, in essence, it varies from airline to airline, from terminal to terminal.
Exactly right, and it varies from contractor to contractor. You know, we in the past when I was Inspector General, we did investigations at airline and airport by airport. We found things like unaccounted for passes and keys and identity badges, and some trained and some had woefully inadequate training, and there was no seamless web of security. And unfortunately, even the best airport is at the mercy of the worst airport, because all you have to do is board behind security in the bad airport and land behind security in the good airport, and there you go. You've compromised it.
We have a couple callers waiting, and one who's on a car phone. I don't want to make them, you know, drive off the road or anything here, so let's talk with them. This is a listener, Tara Hote, on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yeah, hi. One of the measures that I haven't heard discussed very well is to arm the pilots of the aircraft. If the aircraft can't be hijacked because there's armed people on it, then I think you've gone to the root of the problem. We're talking about marshals, you know, which is expensive, which seems redundant to me. Most of these pilots are military-trained people. If they're willing to carry weapons, which I understand they could have done before 1995, and, you know, I'm hearing a lot of things, but I hear the gun control lobby objected to the carrying of guns on aircraft by good guys. What's wrong with that? What's the pros and cons of that approach?
Well, actually, there are a couple things. It's a very good idea, and you would not believe the number of calls I have gotten from pilots since this instance asking me if they did decide to carry a weapon, if they were breaking any laws. And, of course, they obviously have to claim it and take it through security and all of that. But that has been one of the concerns of pilots. That in conjunction with fortified doors. So if someone is going to come after the pilot, at least you have something better than a bathroom door with a, you know, really cheap lock. No matter how fortified the door is, I think you're going to hope for them being slowed down, and then the pilots want a weapon to protect themselves. There's a couple problems. One, I know we're all getting old, and I am too, but we're rapidly approaching the day and age in aviation where most of our pilots are not former military. That the Vietnam-era pilots are just about to hit mandatory retirement age, so most of our pilots will not have had military training. So we're going to have to be sure that they are trained in the use, and I'm sure they would want that too. And also we're probably going to have special bullets, special armament. And so it will take a measure of training, and we and given the outcry from pilots, I'm sure that is something that's being considered.
Well, that's very good. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call. You know, the caller mentioned the air marshals, and there's also a proposal to greatly expand the number of air marshals. These are people who are armed with the special ammunition, as you mentioned, that doesn't pierce the airplane and cause a problem.
Yeah, the interesting thing about that is that special munitions actually are especially deadly to humans. So they could be for a variety of reasons that, you know, we don't need to go into, but they actually would be very effective. Now, the Air Marshals program, I mean, people are talking about this. This is new. Actually, it's a very old program. It was one of the programs that when I was Inspector General, I fought to save, but it was largely disassembled. It dwindled from about 2,000 when I was there to 250 to about 30, I think, at the last time I checked. Because of money. It was perceived that it was not needed and there wasn't money to keep these people trained and up to speed, so it was allowed to dwindle. We can do that again, obviously. I probably at this juncture, if we were going to re-initiate it, obviously you have to have training not only as a law enforcement officer, but you have to have specialized training in what's called shoot-no-shoot scenarios. When is it a nervous passenger versus when is it a hijacker starting an incident? That training takes time. That training's expensive, but it's very, very important. I would actually start, if I was doing it, with retired law enforcement officers and then send them for the specialized training and then deploy them.
Now, these are people that are put on random flights, or at least as far as anybody knows, they're random.
Well, they were. They were put on random flights. Obviously, you don't know who they are. They're not in uniform, because otherwise, what good would it do? They'd know if you had a marshal on your plane or not if they were in uniform, and they randomly rode flights all over the country. They were highly trained. But people are talking about now the LL scenario where you have a non-uniform security, armed security officer on every flight. Now we have about 40,000 flights a day, so we're talking about a pretty big federal security force.
Right. Well, our lines are almost all full. Let's go on and talk with some more callers. Next up, someone in Champaign on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, this is really apropos of the previous caller, but it seems to me that, you know, now we're going into a national hysteria about airport security, which obviously something along that line is needed. But yes, I think that there's no reason why this last attack couldn't have been forestalled with very easy measures. Wouldn't require marshals or anything of that sort. If you have a stout door that between the cabin and the cockpit, and nobody gets through that door under any circumstances, a box cutter is not going to get through that with a deadbolt lock and so on and so forth. It could be that the flight attendants could have stun guns or something of that sort if they needed to use them, and then a way to signal a pilot that there are terrorists here, and within minutes he could be on his way to landing at an airport. This kamikaze type thing would really not be that difficult to overcome. It's just that nobody was expecting it, apparently.
Well, one of my, until now, I don't suppose I'd ever want to watch again, but one of my favorite movies was always Air Force One, where they did obviously have fortified doors. They took care of that with plastic explosives. I think the thing on the door was the aim is to slow them down, give the pilots a chance to divert, give the pilots, you know, if they're armed, to get their own arms out. Of course, they're not now, but those are some of the things on the table. So I think the door idea is really aiming to slow them down. And it'd have to be coupled with a policy. We can put all of the doors on the world, and the pilots, you know, if they're, you know, compassionate, concerned folks, unless you have the rule that says they can't come out under any circumstances, they're going to come to the aid of their passengers and crew being murdered. That's just the way we are. And, you know, it's good that we're that way, but we're going to have some pretty strong policies about you can't ever come out.
They already do have some things that they could use. Don't most cockpits have an axe?
Yes.
They could also have a long pole with knives on the end, which no passenger could bring on board, of course, and would be hard to overcome. They could put in a number of things that would make this type of activity pretty remote.
I fear in focusing on this type of activity, see, that's the way we got the security policy we have. We basically put in place, after every terrorist or criminal attack, people have forgotten the PSA plane, which was in a fired American airline, not American Airlines, but a fired U.S. Airlines employee, who then took to a flight to kill his supervisor and kill the pilots and bring down the plane. And so in that case, we put in the real-time processors for identification, so you could immediately take somebody off the rolls when they were fired. So we focus on these things event at a time. Right now, I would be turning my attention to other possibilities. I do not think they will repeat the same thing, and I am worried that we will focus on fortifying the doors and not worry, for example, about the catering kitchens in a foreign country.
Right. I fully understand. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. We'll get right on next to our next caller, since our lines are all full. But, you know, just a quick follow-up. It's one thing to say the pilot can carry a gun. It's another thing to tell that pilot you are now expected to shoot to kill if somebody tries to enter the cockpit, without permission, and to expect them to have the training and the judgment to exercise that level of decision.
Right, and the training is usually the point. I mean, I like to remind people, and I found this in the two massive U.S. investigations we did on airport security when I was Inspector General. You can have all the equipment and armament and detectors and bomb sniffers in the world, but if the humans that run them aren't trained and aren't vigilant, it's going to fail. So if we're going to arm people on the plane, I want them well trained.
Let's go next to a listener on line number two. This is also on a car phone. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Whoa.
A couple issues. One, let me tell you, I'm a frequent flyer, 4 to 6 flights a week every week, and I'm also a deputy sheriff. My comment is I don't believe that an airplane is any place for a firearm just because of all of the possibilities that could happen. Secondly, I also seem to think that there's a knee-jerk reaction to the security issues. taking the knives out of first class, going through all of the luggage, this extreme amount of time that's going to be involved for business travelers is going to cripple and delay an already a bad situation. I agree with the previous callers, is if there is no way for the cockpit to be compromised, then how could there ever be a situation where the plane is used as a terrorist weapon? Pilots being compassionate people, if their passengers or flight attendants are going to be threatened, I would expect them, just being compassionate as a human being, to try to assist those people. We have to make it not a policy, but make it impossible for those pilots to open that door after the plane takes off.
What do you think?
Well, that is one approach to it. I don't think we're being knee-jerk. I think what we're being is reactive. We're reacting, and the caller is very right, and I can tell he's in law enforcement because, you know, if they attack you one way one time, they're not going to attack you the exact same way the next time. So, you know, he's correct, you know, the bit about steak knives and all that. You know, now that they know their steak knives off, I guess we will never have a steak knife terrorist attack, but that's the problem. We're reactive to what's happening now. We're going to fortify, you know, certain things, and the next strike will be something different. But, yes, it's true. I mean, if you lock those pilots in that cockpit and they cannot come out, that also means, of course, that others cannot come in. We have had situations, and a couple come to mind. There has been a situation where one pilot was incapacitated, literally slumped over and died at the controls on one flight. We had, other situations where people have needed to come in the cockpit. There was even on the Swiss Air 111 where the cockpit was on fire and they left the cockpit. So obviously the pilots have to be able to override, and I would assume that somewhere in the cabin, if we're really going to be serious on this, there would be no way for anyone in the cabin to override it. So we better be prepared for that. But indeed, no one could get to the pilot if it's sealed off and that's it.
Well, what I'm afraid is going to happen is then they're going to say, okay, I mean, now belts and shoestrings and hairpins, and then where does it stop as far as what could possibly be used as a weapon?
Right.
And that is all, if we can't get there, the possibilities of something happening in the cockpit, even though it's a true possibility, is probably more rare than what we feel that the risk of the terrorist taking control of it. One more comment, and I'll get off at somebody else. I also believe it is now true that the airplanes now, the majority of airplanes in the larger airports, can be flown and landed automatically.
That's right.
So there again, that takes away some of the issue of the emergency actually in the cockpit itself. And I appreciate the time, and I'll get off and let somebody else comment.
Okay, thanks for your call.
And the caller's right about another thing. Obviously, all of us know what the inside of planes looks like. There are, you know, weapon-like pieces of metal on the plane itself. So, like I said, we fortify and lock off the cockpit. I don't want to do that at the expense of not looking at other possible ways for attack.
Well, and I think as, during the last hour, we talked about, terrorism a bit and the way that we're going about or about to go about combating it. And I think the statement was made, if somebody really wants to do some damage, they're going to figure out a way to do it. And so the only real security is to not have people wanting to do that damage.
Well, yes, but in the wake of previous events, ordinarily what has happened, I can't say anything I guess is ordinary about terrorist attacks, but for example, Pan Am 103, that terrorist attack, the terrorists took advantage of a very weak system. In that case, Pan Am had actually gotten waivers from doing 100% bag-to-passenger matches. The FAA official who was responsible for that was singled out for a special criticism. The FAA was partially responsible for that, and there was a known weakness there. And they didn't close it. They weren't even following their own rules. And it'll be interesting as the things sort out here. I think that they took advantage of our own known weaknesses, and indeed I think we can make the situation a lot better. I will be the last one you will ever hear say we can't defend ourselves from this. Indeed, lots of things have been thwarted, and I think we're smart and we're, you know, Americans will put up with a lot of inconvenience to make the system work. And indeed, this attack could clearly have been prevented.
Our lines are all full. Let's go on and talk with some more callers. Next up, a listener in Urbana on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
I wonder if your guest would comment on a report on the BBC last night that there had been a congressional study, as I understand it was congressional, certainly federal, which found in 97 that our procedures in airports were woefully lax and that they should be upgraded to those of the Europeans. Had you heard of that study?
Well, yes, actually I was Inspector General. We did those nationwide investigations in 93, 92, 93, and 95, 96, and we issued reports saying exactly that to the Secretary of Transportation, both houses of Congress and the White House, and in 96 to the National Security Advisor. And the response to that by the Federal Aviation Administration, the official position was that the risk to domestic aviation was low, and therefore the investment in additional security was not warranted. They had the warnings, and they simply discredited them, which is really astonishing because of the FBI figures, which are available widely, on the number of terroristic incidents and attempts. It has been steadily rising.
Somebody has a lot of egg on their face today, huh?
Well, worse
not
than that, and I am especially disturbed that the response by the airlines is to run to Congress to get Congress to A, bail them out, and B, say that nobody can hold them responsible for this. You know, that's going to be determined after we get the evidence in, and without a doubt, they will be found to be, you know, responsible, at least at a minimum in large part. At a maximum, of course, it was a criminal act. But the jury's still out on who all did what, and I'm afraid our government is going to also get a measure of criticism.
Well, thank you. Interesting that one of the people who had brought that out was here today.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for the call. Well, let me ask you, what are some of the differences in the way that we deal with airport security, either at a governmental or private, you know, industry level, from, you know, some of the European nations? And, you know, there are certainly some very, in the case of Israel, for example, the Ben-Gurion Airport is, one, you know, regarded as the most secure in the world. What are some of the differences in the way we approach these issues?
Well, the way we approach it, as I mentioned, is we farm it out and contract it out to the lowest bidder. Two levels removed. The FAA puts it on the airlines, and the airline contracts out to the lowest bidder, and that's just the way we work it. In most foreign countries, and certainly in those that have had terroristic incidents and threats in the past, airport security and airlines, you know, the security for a traveling public is a federal law enforcement function. It is either performed by national police or it is performed by the military. I actually like a mix of both. I think that it should be national police in the event of attack or war, as we are, you know, our president says we're headed into. You actually may need the assistance of military as well to beef up security, but that is how most other nations do it.
We have several callers waiting. We'll get right to them. We're about at our midpoint, so let me reintroduce our guest this morning. During this hour, Focus 580, we're talking with Mary Schiavo. She is the former Inspector General for the U.S. Department of Transportation. She held that position from 1990 to 1996. She's currently an aviation attorney and professor of aviation at Ohio State University, and she's author of the book Flying Blind, Flying Safe, and we're talking about the future of air travel, and would welcome any questions, listeners? We have one line open and the rest are filled. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Peoria on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi.
Yes.
My question is about the safety of the planes themselves. I mean, this was a terrorist act, but planes do crash. And is there anything that it seems to me I remember years ago some talk of action that could be taken to reduce the volatility of the fuel?
Exactly. Very, very close listener you have there. And in fact, it's highly ironic that last month the FAA had a task force meeting of their task force on inerting the fuel tanks and making the fuels less explosive, or inerting fuel tanks and somehow decreasing the flammability of the fuel or the mixtures in the fuel tank. That had been tested, probably 10 years ago. They had one major test. The test was a failure, and the FAA pretty much wrote it off. After TW-800, they revisited the issue of decreasing the flammability of the fuels, and just last month they had a meeting and didn't really take any action. So the issue's been on the table, boy, well over 10 years, and really hasn't made much progress, largely because they say it would be expensive to switch fuels.
But now we're talking about willingness to incur additional expense.
That's right.
And that might be something to reopen.
I would agree, and the they're fortunate on this particular advisory committee with the FAA. They do have some very good people on it. On this one, they allowed some private citizens to participate. They have a counterpart of mine from the University of Michigan on it, who's a wonderful expert. So they have some intelligence on that community, some good folks from out there who know their stuff, but maybe now they will listen, and I think it, given that it has come up in several different scenarios to save lives, not just terrorism, but also in the wake of TW-800, which was a malfunction. So certainly I think something that will get a lot more closer attention now.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. Moving right on next to a listener west of Champaign on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. This has nothing to do really with safety per se, but 2 or 3 years ago, an Egyptian airline went down right out of New York, and there was suspicion that the man had flown the plane into the ocean. And has that ever been resolved, or was there any?
Yes.
I don't know. It just seems like we never heard really what happened.
Well, we never heard what happened somewhat intentionally. The National Transportation Safety Board had hearings on the matter. Almost a year ago. The crash was October 31st, 1999, and the United States National Transportation Safety Board commenced the investigation. The Egyptian authorities were actually angry with the U.S. government because the NTSB and the preliminary report said it looked like the pilot intentionally did it. The Egyptians objected. We did not officially release that as a finding, but we released enough of a report. It's actually online at the NTSB website, but it was believed by our government, by our National Transportation Safety Board, to be suicide, suicide murder by that pilot, who was indeed an Egyptian pilot. The biggest mystery about that plane, which has questions swirling around it even now, where there were maybe about 2 to 3 dozen Egyptian military officials on that plane.
Huh.
Egypt would not release the names and identity of those officials. So we have these military personnel on the plane. We don't know really fully who they are to this date, and they were killed. Now, to me, that requires us to reopen the investigation even to that accident.
It could have been a heads up or something, maybe. I don't know.
Well, and, you know, since it's clear that these extremists are willing to, readily die for their cause, if it was necessary to take out those individuals on that plane for whatever, it appears now that certainly one of their terrorists could have been compelled, or maybe would have voluntarily been willing to do that. So I think all those things are on the table now, and it certainly makes that one even more suspicious than it already was.
Uh-huh. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We'll go next to a listener in Normal on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Okay. Hi, Mary.
Good morning.
How's it going today?
Okay.
Look, I'm calling in regard to a flight I'm planning to take on a foreign airline in about 3 weeks. Did you tell us that foreign airlines had a greater, better standards of safety than our domestic airlines do?
Depends on the airline. Most major foreign carriers have a comparable safety track record. You know, statistically, what are the, you know, your chances of being involved in an accident with them are about the same for majors.
I'm talking about a major airline. It's Air France.
Mm-hmm. Air France has also had its problems. You know, America isn't alone. In fact, I flew Air France just after the bombings, and I had to. I was going over there for an event I had to participate in, and they had bombings at Orly, and I was going over on Air France. Air France took extraordinary measures. In fact, each one of us was strip searched, and all baggage was checked.
Wow.
Nobody objected, I might add. Obviously, we were strip searched by matrons in private rooms.
Sure.
Holy smoke, that's really something, isn't it?
Yes, and, you know, I certainly didn't object, and I was thrilled that they did it because I had to go in there.
Hey, Mary, I've got another question. And the other question concerns what you said about airlines or whoever it is turning their security over to the lowest bidder.
Right.
Is that right?
That's right.
Yes, okay. Then is there profiteering going on from this practice? For example, if they have $2 million to hire people and they spend $3 million or $1 million, what happens to the other million?
Well, I think that the profiteering goes right down the line. I think that security companies obviously hire minimum wage employees and certainly don't invest in them training, and they weren't hurting. I mean, it's not like they were going bankrupt providing this security. Now is when I fear profiteering. Today, the Secretary of Transportation is going to meet with the airlines to discuss both a financial bailout and security. I would hate to see the billions we are going to spend for security turned over to the airlines, because right there, in my opinion, is profiteering. They have failed and failed miserably, and they no longer deserve to have that trust and responsibility of security. It must be federalized.
Yeah, that'll be punished for it.
I think so, but, you know, not all people agree with me. There are actually people who now are saying that, well, you know, we don't want the airlines to go bankrupt, so maybe this time around at least they ought to not be held accountable. I think you have to be held accountable each and every time.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. Well, let me ask you to talk about the financial condition of the airlines. You know, Midway Airlines just filed for bankruptcy protection, canceled all flights, laid off its workers. United Airlines has lost $600 million so far this year. That was before last week. Are we looking at a major series of airline bankruptcies?
Yes and no. I need to shed some historical facts on this, however.
Sure.
Midway Airlines went bankrupt before this. I think they are taking advantage of the situation to say, aha, see, now if you hold airlines accountable, we'll go bankrupt. Excuse me, Midway, but that is taking advantage of a bunch of deceased people. I am outraged that they would say that. They were bankrupt. They filed bankruptcy before this happened. Midway's been through, not this particular version of Midway, but Midway's been through bankruptcy before. I was in
Sure.
the Department of Transportation when the previous Midway filed bankruptcy. I was in the Department of Transportation when TWA filed bankruptcy twice. So airlines go through the cyclical thing. Bankruptcy does not mean they're going to shut down and we'll have no airline service. Bankruptcy means usually that they reorganize their debt. And in any time of war, we have had a downturn. During Desert Storm, air travel was off, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, more than 20%. So I am aghast at the airlines, and I think they are taking advantage of these, you know, well over 5,000 murdered people to try to seek economic concessions. And right now, frankly, I think that they're, you know, all they're threatening us about their financial condition. I really would have harsh words for the airlines if I was the government, because, you know, my concern is not their financial condition right now. And their bankruptcies started before this.
We're talking this morning with Mary Schiavo. She's a former inspector general for the U.S. Department of Transportation, currently professor of aviation at Ohio State University. And we're talking about the future of air travel. We have one caller waiting and time for some others. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Let's talk with...
Can I add one?
Sure.
I just have to add one more thing here, because I don't want to see, you know, these poor victimized people taken advantage of by this airline rhetoric. Since deregulation, and I hate to bring up deregulation because everybody, you know, has heard me rant and rave about the damages deregulation caused, but since deregulation, 200 carriers have gone bankrupt. Now for the carriers to say they're in financial straits because of this tragedy, well, in part, they were responsible for airline security, but to bail them out at the expense of these poor, poor victims, to me, is just disgusting that they would even suggest it.
You mentioned deregulation. Do you think that we need some kind of renewed regulation of the airlines?
Absolutely, and I wrote about this and spoke about this long before this tragedy. Deregulation had insidious effects. Now, I admit it sounds like a good idea when you initially hear it. It was the Carter administration, but there were a lot of people that had a lot of misinformed self-interest, and I'm not talking about President Carter. There were others who took advantage of the situation to push through a lot of really crazy things during deregulation, and we are still feeling the effects. All these years later, much of this is a fallout from that hasty and ill-thought-out decision, and it is time to put it all on the table. We have to re-regulate certain areas of our airline industry.
Let's talk with some more listeners. We have a caller next in Champaign on line number 3. Good morning. You're on Focus
morning.
5. Yes.
Mary, let me start off by thanking you very much for being a very honest, outspoken defender of the traveling public. It's really admirable that you're doing this. I also totally concur with you with the way the security is handled by the airlines. I've had my share of problems with security, and sometimes it seems like our response is reactionary even to what has happened. Like I was totally surprised that people were allowed to take knives on planes to begin with. Now we're not allowing to do that anymore. I'm not saying we shouldn't, but they're not going to use knives next time. They're going to use something else. And our procedures seem to be, our reactions to these incidents seem to be sort of, like I said, reactionary to what has happened. And one time I was traveling back from Europe on an American airline, not American airline, but a U.S. airline. And, of course, as you know, there's security in Europe before you board the plane, additional security. And because I'm a U.S. citizen, I've lived in this country for 25 years, but I was born in Middle East, and, of course, my American passport says that I was born in another country. They harassed me so much. Because of that, they asked me a lot of questions. Several other people went through security before I did through other lines. They asked me for a university ID. They asked me for a business card. And eventually, she took my ticket, my passport, and everything else. She said she had to clear that with a supervisor. She went and cleared me up and came back. They allowed me to proceed to the ticket counter. There was a problem with my ticket, so they asked me to go to outside the secure area to clear that up. When I returned, I approached the roped area from another direction, and there was a lady, a security person, standing there, and I explained to her that I had already gone through security, and I just had to fix this up. And she opened the rope, let me in. I could have carried anything I wanted back in. I mean,
wow.
That's so inconsistent. When I came back, I was very furious. I contacted the airline through an email. They told me, well, security is important, this and that. And I said, I understand that. I'm not against security. Why did you have to treat me different? Mm-hmm. They said, blah, blah, blah. They gave me 750 miles on my frequent traveler. That was their response. I contacted FAA. They said, seems like you've been discriminated against. File a complaint with us. And that is, right now, it's in the process of being investigated. I was just appalled that, on one hand, just a few minutes earlier, they put me through so much harassment just because I was born in another country. Mm-hmm. And then a few minutes later, without any questions, she let me in.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have done anything during those minutes that I was outside.
I know. I mean, and you make such an excellent, excellent point. And, you know, I'm an aviation educator, too. We put citizens who, you know, fit some sort of an appearance or background profile, but there's, you know, you are citizens. You are us. And then we go to the opposite, really nut, you know, just crazy opposite of literally giving anyone flight training who comes in this country and manages to get admitted to a university or manages to be able to pay for flight training. And you say, excuse me, but shouldn't you really start with foreign nationals in this country rather than, you know, starting by hassling with citizens, et cetera? Because in the end, the terrorist cell is not over there. The terrorist cell is here, but it was manned, other than they have announced there was one citizen involved, it was manned by foreign people who were in this country on visas, and our United States government gave them the visas and then pretty much lost the trail.
Well, in this recent case, apparently some of these people were being tracked by CIA, and the FBI missed the notice by a few days. Apparently they should have been looking for them, and I don't know what – I mean, we're spending billions and billions of dollars on intelligence agencies, whether it's FBI or CIA and other intelligence agencies. And then, I mean, it's really – I mean, this is not a good time to talk about this because of the horrendous, you know, human side to all of this. But eventually I hope somebody looks into this. Now we're going to spend billions of dollars more on – intelligence. I hope we spend it in the right place and we catch the right people.
That's right, and the next attack won't be the same. I don't want us to just do the,
absolutely,
you know, just respond to this one. And there's an interesting thing about intelligence. I used to be a federal prosecutor in the U.S. Department of Justice, and one of the things I had to do was prepare these orders for tracking foreign nationals, and it's done very legally, and it's done with, you know, just like with if you're tracking somebody in the U.S. with a wiretap and all of that, and the proper authority, and a judge signs it, and it's a lot of things to go through. But the problem is this: domestically, it's the FBI, you'd be surprised what all they do. But internationally, it's the CIA, and in this instance, as in other instances, there's a disconnect there. There's a little bit of competition. There's a little bit of one-upmanship. Mm-hmm. But we have this big, break between the CIA and the FBI, and I never worked with the CIA. I've worked with the FBI for years and years and years, And they try, but if you don't have a seamless web, there's always a hole that something can fall into.
Well, thank you very much, Mary, and keep up the good work.
Thank you.
Thanks
Bye-bye.
For the call. Well, we have a couple calls, and I'll get right to them, but just one question sort of following on the last listener. Profiling is likely to be used a lot more given the reaction to last week. This is something that is perhaps somewhat controversial, but mm-hmm. I mean, I guess what can you say about the efficacy or, you know, wisdom of, sort of profiling passengers and maybe looking at certain passengers more carefully if they happen to have a Middle Eastern sort of name?
Well, the problem with looking at the names, as was already pointed out, they used variations of the spelling. But here, here the terrorists came here. They were operating from the United States. They had frequent flyer accounts. They booked on Travelocity. They had done a pretty good job of looking like all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Even things like, for example, I have right now on my computer here the pictures of these individuals. One of the things on our hot points for screening people was facial hair. They don't have facial hair. So these profiling things don't work. And besides, the important point is on the profiling, they didn't have the right list. They weren't actually checking these people against the lists of known terrorists or people that the CIA and the FBI were watching. So no amount of profiling did any good. Profiling is very problematic in this country. I am the number one advocate for aviation safety and security, but there are some profiling things that will cause problems and will fall, and you cannot do it on the basis of religion, race, sexual orientation. And the reason we do profiling is we were not willing to invest in full security. We profile because we don't want to X-ray or run through explosive detection all of the bags. So we profile people to figure out whose bags we ought to look at. If we did 100% security, then this profiling, which is very poor, U.S. profiling is not very good. So we do this spot checking. As long as we're spot checking, they're going to be holed.
Yeah. Well, let's talk with some more callers. Next up, someone on the campus here on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello.
Yes.
I'd like to get your opinion on the U.S. government simply buying the airlines, all of them, and nationalizing it, and maybe get the, seems like for the money, you could get the Israelis to administer it. I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Well.
Okay. The idea of the U.S. government buying the airlines, of course, that responsibility would be given to the FAA, and I actually had occasion on, the FAA has about 253 airplanes, and I have on many occasions have had cause to have to investigate their operation. Let me tell you, you don't want the FAA running the airlines. What you do want, though, I would agree with part of the caller, what you do want is the United States government to take over the security function. Again, you don't want to give it to a civilian agency, the FAA. FAA's had that responsibility, and they have failed. What you want to give it to is an agency that's both trained in law enforcement, in security, in interdiction, and has great experience in aviation. In fact, more experience in aviation than the FAA, and the only organization like that is the United States Coast Guard, which is already trained to protect the maritime ports of America. It has a fleet of airplanes. It has, it can do everything the FAA can do, but the idea is that you then have federal security. So I think if you take over the security from the airlines, all the airlines have to do is run the planes, fill the seats. A friend of mine who's an executive at Southwest said, he said, look, we're just an airline. We aren't going to provide you with, satisfaction in life and everything else. We're just an airline. Well, I think it's time to let an airline be just an airline and the government take security.
Well, very good. Let's go next to a listener in Urbana on line number 1. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. This is a big topic. I don't know if I can phrase myself as well as I'd like. One thing I think is that we have, because of the present circumstances, I think we're going towards hysteria in security. I think that a state which puts security above all else tends towards totalitarianism and loss of freedom for its citizens. I think that the record of the airlines, the safety of the airlines, has been quite good as a whole. And I think what one has to achieve is a certain amount of reasonableness. And of course, when you have reasonableness, you're going to have, there are going to be certain risks in it. And I think if we want to have a free society, we have to have those risks. And that I can't take a little penknife to cut my nails on an airline seems to me to show the ridiculousness of the current mania on security. And I resent it, for one. Of course you have to have security, but there has to be a reasonable balance, and I think where we're going now is way overboard. You can always criticize security. We have cars on the road. There are many, many people killed. You could put a stoplight on every intersection in the country, and you'll save some people that way, but it's not a reasonable act to follow. So that's my comment. You can comment on that.
Sure. You know, the problem with the car analogy and being in aviation safety and security, I've heard the car analogy literally since 1974 when I got my pilot's license. The problem with that is, yes, you know, you have cars out there and they make mistakes too and could be hijacked and whatever, and then when they run the stop sign, one, two, you know, maybe max four people are killed. Here, when you
But what is the overall record? The overall record per passenger mile is quite good.
You fall into the statistical trap. Per mile flown, yes. Per mile flown, the airlines beat. But per trip, when you look at it on a per trip basis, which is how our insurance companies write the insurance because it's a better measure of the risk, then the automobile wins. Unfortunately, the statistics don't hold up on that. But in light of this attack on the World Trade Center and now realizing, particularly as we're heading into a very dire national action, I'm afraid we're going to have to agree to disagree on that one. The most paralyzing thing our nation could encounter right now is the fear that every time you get on a plane, you could be a victim of some terrorist attack. And the best way to combat that is really go out and combat the problem. And, you know, I have to comment, I don't know why aviation thinks that they're sort of special and you have special constitutional rights on an airplane that you don't have, like, let's use a department store. You know, if you ever watch the shift change at, like, you know, Macy's or these big department stores, I once noticed people walking in with little clear plastic-handled bags, and I thought, oh, look at that. They've issued them little matching pocketbooks. But in fact, what it was is to protect their, you know, Gucci, you know, shoes or their, you know, their jewelry, they made all their employees come to work with their, you know, their lipstick and their money and their lunch snacks in a clear plastic bag. And I thought, you know, this is really interesting. We're willing to go to those lengths. And they had armed guards stationed in the stores. And I thought, you can do this for a department store, but when you do this on an airline, people say, well, you know, my God, you're going to trample on my constitutional rights. Already by law, when you get on a plane, you give up a number of them for safety and security. And I think that the thing I see as reaching the fever pitch in this country is people worried that we're going to trample on their constitutional rights by protecting, you know, how we should have protected 6,000 people in New York City from having the ultimate insult to their constitutional rights. And I'm afraid you won't get me to agree on that one.
We literally just have a minute left. Mary Schiavo, what can travelers do to better deal with the current crisis?
Well, I would actually recommend people, if they don't have to travel, you know, Americans are so wonderfully compassionate and good, and I've already gotten many, many calls from people who say, you know, I just don't feel like traveling when my nation's headed into war. Then don't. I personally have canceled all my travel for two reasons, not just because I'm not happy with what they have done in response to this, and I don't think the security is up to par, but once we head into military action, we will have even stricter. If you think it's strict now, everybody's forgetting what Desert Storm was like. We had very strict rules, and I also don't want to get stranded someplace because then we're a burden on the system. We're stranded in an airport someplace, and we have to get home, and we're yelling and screaming and complaining. We're not helping the country. So it's, you know, it's part security and safety, but it's also part patriotism, and that I'm not going to be part of the problem. I'm going to, you know, do my best to fix it.
Well, very good. We'll have to leave it there since we're here at the end of our time. Our guest has been Mary Schiavo. Her book is Flying Blind, Flying Safe. You should be able to find that in bookstores and libraries. And she's professor of aviation at Ohio State University. Mary Schiavo, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We'll have to leave it there for today on Focus 580. Time to hand things off to Tom Rogers, host of the Afternoon Magazine. Tom?